Okay, welcome to our last lecture of the semester. Before we start, as always, are there any leftover questions of last week? Okay, if not, we will restart at the parametric statistical outlier detection methods with a Krups test. I speeded through that last time and decided to repeat it this time with some more time to do that. As said last time, Krups test is a statistical test to test whether outliers exist in a univariate data set under a specific assumption, specifically that they are created with normal distribution. For this, we have a null hypothesis, specifically that the data set contains no outliers. To reject or allow this null hypothesis, we now do this Krups test. Therefore, we first compute the so-called Krups statistic. G is the maximum of a specific data point xi and the mean of a data set, divided through the sample standard deviation, because we have the sample standard deviation, and of course also the sample standard deviation. And now this g, value g, is compared to a boundary, I would call it, where we simply compute the number of values minus one divided through the square root of n times the square root of a more complicated formula, at least a more complicated looking formula. However, it's pretty simple if you know that this t2 in here and this t squared in here and this t squared in here are just the values you take out of a t-distribution table at a specific set significance level. As always, you can set the significance level depending on your needs. It might be 0.05, it might be 0.005, and things like that. This significance level has to be set by you, and then you can just look this value up in a table. And then you divide the value you looked up through the number of data points minus two plus the number you looked up. And now, if you computed both g and this more complicated looking formula, then you can compare both. If g is higher than this significance value, I would call it, you reject the null hypothesis. And since the null hypothesis was the data set contains no outliers, if you reject the null hypothesis, you see that there are outliers. Of course, this is just possible to do to be done in a univariate data set. Of course, you also might want to detect outliers in a multivariate data set. So a data set containing two or more attributes, not only one attribute. This can be done by extending univariate outlier detection methods, like the Krups test, or using specifically designed outlier detection methods. Two methods we will talk about right now are the Mann-Hallow-Nobis distance, sorry if I'm wrong with that, and the chi-squared statistic. Chi-squared is something you already should know. Yeah, let's go to these two. Let's start with the Maha-Lo-La-No-Bis distance. Again, sorry if I pronounced that wrong. We measure the distance of an abstract object X to the distribution, to the dataset's distribution. So the more distance between a specific data point and the rest of the dataset or the distribution of the dataset, the more likely it is to be an outlier. And basically that's what's done. We take a look at a data point X, again, multivariate, so there are more variables in that, and we compare it to the specific mean of its specific attribute of our multivariate dataset. Transpose that. Why do we need to transpose that? Because we have multivariates, so we have multiple values in X. Each one is one variate, one attribute. And with subtraction of the mean of that specific attribute, we might end up with something like, we have a data set with the attributes A, B, C. Then we calculated this value for each one, and then we end up with a vector, and this vector then has to be transposed for this calculation to work. Then we take a look at the covariance matrix in worst. The covariance matrix is something you should already know from the preprocessing lecture, if I'm correct, and multiply it again with a non-transposed calculation of value minus mean. And once we have this value, we can also use that with the Krebs test to either reject our thesis that we have no outliers, or we go with that, that we have no outliers. Again, the same basic principle. We go with the null hypothesis that we do not have any outliers. The second option is to check the chi-squared statistic. Again, something you should already know from earlier lectures, where we try to find multivariate outliers by simply calculating the sum of all values. So if we have n values in our data set, we sum it n times up, take a look at the specific value minus the mean, square that, and then divide it through the mean again. And if this chi-squared statistic gets very large, then we have found an outlier. Both formulas are pretty easy to apply. Here we, of course, need a significance level. In this case, we have to define our threshold not by significance, but we can, again, also defined by significance, but we never talked about that during the first lecture, so I won't here as well. A big problem with these parametric methods, whether they are talking about univariate or multivariate data sets, is not of any meaning in this case, is that the outlier methods we talked about until now wouldn't be able to detect outliers that lay in between huge data clouds. Of course, if you have three big clusters, one big cluster up here, one big cluster up here, one big cluster up here, then the points in between might also be outliers. But with our methods like chi-squared, the Grubbs test, we wouldn't be able to detect them because the mean is in here. And therefore, this little point in here has a low distance to the other points and therefore wouldn't be detected as an outlier. And that's something that can only be solved if we assume there are more normal distributions. The data set isn't built by one normal distribution, but by multiple. For example, we can do that, or we can handle that if we go with two normal distributions. Then, of course, we can only detect outliers between these two normal distributions. And that's something that we can do by combining both normal distributions and both the likelihood of something being an outlier in these normal distributions by combining it, for example, with a formula like this, the FFP, which is the point, x, and with the two normal distributions n1 and n2, equals the function for the first normal distribution plus the function for the second normal distribution. And then we can use something called an expectation maximation algorithm. I just linked that because it's not part of our lecture in here, but it's part of our lead book. So if you're interested in how to do it finally with that, you can look it up. It's not required for the exam again, but yeah, you can look that up. To learn these parameters to get to the best possible detection method. And in this case, if the probability is low that it belongs to any of these two clusters, then we are an outlier. So if you have learned the standard deviation and the means and got to the best possible distribution of normal distributions, and then still our probability is pretty low for point x, then we are an outlier. Non-parametric methods exist also. For example, a method you should already know, a histogram. And a histogram can pretty easily be used to detect outliers. If you have a data set with numerical points, numerical data in that. For example, we have transactions that have a certain amount per transaction. And we draw a histogram for that. And we see that transactions between $0 and $1,000 make up 60% of transactions. Transactions between $1 and $2,000 make up 20% of cases, and so on. We can see that there are cases, bins with more transactions in them, and of course there are cases or ranges with less transactions in them. And there we can simply define a threshold. If a bin has below 1% of transactions, all transactions within that bin are regarded outliers. Of course, we have to define again a threshold that is defining or deciding whether something is an outlier or not. But for example, if we take a look at this histogram and think it goes further to the right, then a transaction with the amount of $7,500 is certainly an outlier because its bin is just under 0.2%. We don't know the exact value because we didn't even draw that histogram, but it's pretty obvious. because only 0.2% are not covered by the histogram. A big problem with this non-parametric methods, however, is that we are not totally without parameters. They are called non-parametric methods, but of course, in a histogram, you still have to choose a bin size. You might have 1,000 per bin, you might have 2,000 per bin, you might have 1,333 per bin. That's something you have to decide. If you make the bin sizes too small, of course, there are a lot of smaller bins with less transactions in them, for example. If you choose a too big bin size, yeah, then there are outliers in some frequent bins. Because if we just decide in this example to create a bin size of $10,000, most of the transactions will end up in this bin. Also, 7,500 would end up in this bin. So with a bin size of 10,000, it wouldn't be regarded an outlier, which is a problem. You have to fine-tune it, and also you have to set this threshold. When is a bin regarded, when are the contents of a bin regarded outliers, and when they aren't. This can be solved by something as the kernel density estimation. This was once part of the lecture, however, we removed it to have some time to talk about your questions after that lecture. So I won't go into detail on that. However, the slides are still part of the slide set. If you're interested in that, you can take a look at them. Again, not part of the exam, just if you're interested in that. It's in the appendix, so can look it up. And these have been the statistical approaches. The next thing we are going to talk about are the proximity-based methods. Specifically, we have two different proximity-based methods, or two different kinds of proximity-based approaches. One are the distance-based methods, and one are the density-based methods. Both go with the assumption that outliers are far away from other points in our data set. And we try to quantify how far away points, objects are from other objects in our case. For this, we have two different kinds, as I said, the distance-based methods that are consulting just the neighborhood of a point, which is defined by a radius, and an object is considered as an outlier if in his direct neighborhood there are not enough points to satisfy a threshold. We will talk about two methods regarding that. And then there are density-based methods that investigate the density relative to its neighbors. I hope that comes clearer once we get to the methods themselves. However, be careful, both kinds of methods can be abbreviated as DB, so don't be confused by that. We start with distance-based methods. Specifically with a nested loop distance-based outlier detection method. Let's say we have a set of data objects, D. And we have a user-defined threshold, R. It's specifically named R to not be confused with epsilon in the density-based clustering algorithms. There's just another name for that. For each object in our data set, then we find this R neighborhood of this specific object. If most objects are not within that neighborhood, then something is an outlier. Let's try to I try to visualize that. Let's go with something like this, and we have a cycle again as our neighborhood. So for this little data point in here, of course, most points are within the our neighborhood. Therefore, it isn't an outlier. If you draw the same cycle around this one, then there are not that many points in there. Therefore, it's regarded an outlier. This threshold, in this case named pi, has to be set as well, and it has to be set between 0 and 1. And then we can just check whether something is an outlier if this the amount of points in the neighborhood divided through the total amount of points is below or equal the threshold. It's pretty simple. We do not have any, let's go to the next point, like in density-based clustering algorithms. But the basic principle of drawing a neighborhood and just counting points in that is similar to that of density-based clustering algorithms. However, since we do not go further from one point, we are not really density-based in this case, but distance-based. This method can be efficiently done by using a nested loop. So for each point in our data set, we start to count the points we have, and then calculate the distance to every other point, and just if it's below the distance threshold in the our neighborhood, then we increase the count by 1, and only if the count exceeds a certain thing, we are not an outlier. If we are below that point, we are regarded an outlier. The problem with that is that we have a big O notation, a complexity of n squared. We have to go through two loops, going through each point squared, which is, of course, a lot of computing power needed for that. This can be a huge problem if we can't hold that in RAM. It can be a problem if the dataset becomes too large, because we have to calculate this all per similarity. We have to check every combination of every object, and that's a problem. An idea on solving that is to check not every pair, but groups of data objects. And this is done by CEL. CEL is a grid-based, distance-based outlier detection method. In this case, we divide our data space into a multi-dimensional grid. In this case, we have a two-dimensional grid, of course. So x and y. X and y. In this dimensional, multi-dimensional grid, we make sure that each cell has a diagonal length, so from here to here, of r divided through 2, so half r. Where r is still the same value as in our naive approach, in our nested loop approach. Therefore, we can also describe, of course, the lengths of the borders. However, that's not of importance. The importance is the diagonal axis. So half of r. And by this, we can now take a look at the points within the fragment, within the cell C. So we are taking a look at only the data points in C right now, and go from there. From there, we have two different kinds of cells. We have one kind, here just described as level one cells, which are the cells directly around the cell we are taking a look at. So every cell that is next to cell C is regarded as a level one cell. Why is that important? If we draw this, it might become somewhat clearer. And we know that this is R half. When we know that this again is R half, so both together are distance R. So two cells next to each other. So even if we have a point in cell C that is right to the left upper border of that cell, we know that every point within this, within here, within here, within here, within here, whatever, is for sure within distance R. So in our R neighborhood. We make sure of that. And that becomes important if we take a look at the rules of cell. I will go back for the next type of cells, but let's go with this first. If we name every point within cell C A, and every object within the level one cells, so the cells around that, B1, then we can make sure that if all values within cell C plus all values within the level one cells added up together, if they are above our threshold we defined, then we can be sure that every point within C is for sure not an outlier. Because we know that there are enough points in the neighborhood of all points within C, within this little cell. The next type of cells are the C2 cells, which are not directly at cell C. They are outside the two cells, the two cell rings around the level one cells. Important, the two rings. Why this? Again, by adding this in here, we have again a radius of R. And we are therefore able to do our next thing, which is the level two-cell pruning rule. If anything, if we add up all the data objects of the cell C, the level 1 cells, and the cell level 2 cells, and they, the amount of these objects in these cells is below our threshold plus 1, then we can for sure say that all objects within C are outliers. Because even with the worst alignment, we know that within the epsilon, the R neighborhood of this point, there cannot be enough points to become to not become an outlier. By using these two rules in combination, we can sort out a lot of points. However, of course, there can be some points where there are not enough points within level one and the cell itself for it to become not to become a normal point, not an outlier. But there are enough points in the two layers for it to not be regarded an outlier. So there's something in between. And these have to be checked the normal way. So there we have to go back, not to an unnested loop, but to another algorithm checking the points within the cells that are not of the level cell one pruning rule or the level two cell pruning rule. So we still have some checking to do. However, we have a lot less manual point per point checking to do. I see some confused faces. Is there anything I should explain in another way? Okay, the confused faces don't want to ask. Okay, then let's go on. It's just a simplification to make this distance-based methods, these distance-based outlier detection methods, faster. It's just something to be faster. The results are exactly the same as the results have been with a nested loop join. It's just faster. Okay, now from the distance-based outlier detection methods to the density-based outlier detection methods. These work with local density, and therefore they are not exactly the same as density-based clustering algorithms as well, even if they share the same prefix. Basically, the density-based outlier detection methods try to measure the density of a point and try to measure the density against its neighbor, of its neighbors. And if the density of a point itself is significantly lower than the density of its neighbors, then it's regarded an outlier. Why is that important? We can use that method to detect local outliers for the first time. Or not for the first time, for statistical methods, that's possible if we have this multiple distributions that are combined. But with distance-based methods, we couldn't detect local outliers. Let's go with this example down here. We have a pretty sparse point cloud on the left side, a pretty high density cluster at the right side, and we have some special points to take a look at. O1, O2, O3, and O4. If we use a distance-based glass ceiling method, outlier detection method, then we wouldn't say that, for example, O1 or O2 is an outlier. However, if we compare O1 and O2 to this dense cluster in here, C1, then they might be an outlier because they are significantly deviating from that little, very dense cluster C1. If we, however, try to compare it with a sparse cloud, the sparse cluster C2, then they wouldn't be outliers. So they are local outliers compared to C1, not to C2. O4 is definitely not a local outlier to C2 because it's in roughly the same grid as all points within C2. For C3, we can discuss whether that is above or below a threshold. In most cases, it will be an outlier, a global outlier for both things. Okay, how can we do that? How can we measure local density? Basically, we need a relative density for a point and its neighbors. Therefore, we define the k distance of an object O, point O, defined as dk of O. This is the distance of O to its k nearest neighbor. So I hope that's something you should you already know. But if this is O and we have only one dimension, then this would be the one nearest neighbor, the two nearest neighbor, the three nearest neighbor, and so on. So starting from the point itself, go to the next point, go to the next point, and so on. So maybe I should write it down. So in here, and so on, of course. We can define k as we want. The distance O to P is the distance between O, the point we are taking a look at, and its k nearest neighbor P. Where we have at least points to make sure that it's the k nearest neighbor. That's basically what these complicated formulas say. This division says in here. So we won't bother to go into detail on that. It's basically just telling us which is the k nearest neighbor. And the k distance of a neighborhood is basically the distance. Not the k-distance neighborhood is the distance, but the k-distance neighborhood is the neighborhood of all points that are closer or equal to the k-nearest neighbor. So, of course, if we are in a multidimensional way, we might have some points that are at the same distance to the third nearest neighbor. They would be part of that neighborhood. So there can be points, more points than k in this neighborhood, but in most cases it will be k points. And then to define the local density, the first idea that comes into mind might be to just measure the average distance of objects in this neighborhood, this k-distance neighborhood, and say that's our density. If we would do that, however, and we have something like this is a neighborhood with a lot of points being pretty close, And the case point being pretty far away, of course, these pretty small distances close to that point have a significant influence to our data point. And that's something we do not want. Therefore, we define Kensity not as the average distance of all points. But we go with a more complicated approach, which ends up in the local outlier factor. For this, we first have to define the so-called reachability distance from a specific point to the point we regard as O. We are talking about, which is object O. And this distance is basically defined as the maximum of the distance to the k nearest neighbor, which is dko. You might remember that from here. And the point, the distance between the two points themselves. So for a specific point, it might either be, if we have taken a look at this point and this point. So this is O. These are our two points, O and or O. With a bracket. Then the distance dk O would of course be this distance. And the other distance would just be the distance between the two points we are talking about. Since we're taking the maximum, the reachability distance would be the longer one. If a point O star is, however, within our reachability distance, then this distance is smaller than the distance to the k nearest neighbor, and therefore, we would take the distance to the k nearest neighbor. And by doing this, we smooth out the problems of having a lot of close points. Because the distance, the reachability distance of O to all these points would be the distance to this point, because it's the k nearest neighbor. And therefore, we have a smoothing distance. Just like with the density-based clustering, all four ways are not really comparable. I have to add up that the reachability distance is not symmetric, so it's not the same to calculate the reachability distance between O star and O to as the reachability distance of O and to a star, because of course they have other neighborhoods, therefore other k nearest neighbors, and therefore we have other reachability distances. Should be pretty obvious to mention. But this is just a point to add. However, if we now have this reachability distance, we can calculate the so-called local reachability density, LRD, of O. With a specific K set, of course, but this is the same as always. And this can be computed by just taking a look at the amount of values within our K neighborhood, divided through the sum of all reachability distances of the points within the O neighborhood of the direction O star to O to O star, and therefore they have to draw it around the neighbors we have to draw this, what I've drawn in here, with regard to the neighbors. And therefore, we're comparing the density of the neighbors to the own net density. And by computing this LRD, we end up with something we can use as the local outlier factor. This local outlier factor is basically the average of all LRDs of O and its k nearest neighbors. Which is defined as we're taking a look at the sum of all points within the neighborhood of O and take a look at the LRD of these points divided through the LRD of a point O itself and divided through the amount of points in the neighborhood. And this basically captures the density of a point itself compared to the other points. Basically, if we have an LOF, local outlier factor of 1, then we have the same same density as all points around it, or the average of all points around it. So 1 would be definitely not an outlier, if we have an LOF of 1. If we are below 1 in the local outlier factor, then we have a higher density than all other points around it. Having a higher density is, of course, not a sign of an outlier. Because if we have a higher density, we are even more part of the group. The problem occurs if the LOF gets significantly higher than 1. So 15 or something like that. Only then, if the LOF gets significantly higher than 1, then a point would be regarded an outlier. Of course, we have to define a threshold for that again. Depends on the project. We can have different LOF thresholds to be regarded an outlier, but it should be significantly higher. So 1.02 definitely is not an outlier. And therefore we are able to detect local outliers as well. Okay, so now we have distance-based outlier detection methods and density-based outlier detection methods. Any questions regarding these proximity-based outlier detection methods? Okay, then quick summarization about the chapter of outlier detection. We have global outliers, we have contextual outliers, we have collective outliers. Not necessarily you have to be of one kind, you can be of multiple kinds as well. You can be a collective outlier, and at the same time you can be a global outlier. You can be a local outlier, a contextual outlier, and a collective outlier. Those are all things that are possible. We talked about how we can approach outlier detection either supervised, when it's more like classification, unsupervised, when it's more like clustering, and semi-supervised is somewhere in between these two. And we talked about statistical approaches or model-based approaches which assume a distribution below the data and then try to work with this distribution to find the probability that a point is generated by this distribution or not. And lastly, we have proximity-based methods, which can be divided into density-based and distance-based methods. that exist. Of course, there are other approaches, like real clustering-based approaches, so that are using, for example, dbScan directly. We didn't talk about that. But since dbScan is able to detect noise, we can, of course, use it as outlier detection method. Noise, in this point, can be regarded noise or outlier. We didn't talk about classification approaches and some other things, but things we didn't talk about are not of that high importance for here. Okay, then we are finished with the last chapter of our lecture, and we can go to the next part, to the final part of our lecture. Of course, feel free to leave if you are not interested in that. I asked you last time to ask questions you want to talk about in the forum. Directly in my thread, only one person did ask for something to talk about. Therefore, I will go through that first, and maybe the persons that asked other questions in the forum are also here, but that's something we'll discuss later. Something I forgot that I should talk about, because I uploaded it together with today's lecture slides. I've also uploaded a little student demo for the exam. This is not the mock exam. Very important. The mock exam is the real deal. However, everyone gets access to the student demo. The student demo is basically the same header or similar header. Of course, student demo is not a real exam, but that's of another thing. But this is basically the first page of a real exam. These are the real processing notices of a real exam. So if you're interested in the processing notices, you can take a look at them in here. And then I also attached some demo questions. These demo questions are created to show you the different kinds of questions you might see in the real exam. For example, there might be an ordering question where you have multiple steps and you have to mark which step it is which. So, of course, in this case, let's go with this example. We have 9 boxes, and we should tick 3. You should only tick 1 box per line. Of course, in this case, it's a pretty easy question. That's also something that is not that often in the real exam, but it's just to show you how to answer that. Of course, in this case, you would mark data preprocess. Sorry, no, I started wrong. Data preprocessing is the first step, so you would mark this here. Then we have data mining, so you would mark the second box and the third box for data post-processing or post-processing. Very important, and that's very important for every question that is answered with these little rectangles, these little squares, try to fill them out as full as possible. We use an object recognition model to recognize which box you ticked via software. And there's a threshold of, I think, 80%. Only if 80% of that box is filled, it's regarded as marked. So try to fill it as full as possible to get the marks for this box. Otherwise, it might happen that it's not detected correctly. And don't just do 81%, do at least 90% to be sure about that. So that's the first kind of question you might see in the real exam. Not of this difficulty, but of this kind. Then there are true-false questions, where you again have to mark one box per line. It's always written up here as well, four completely filled boxes in total. I think that's self-explanatory. You mark the box you think is right for that statement. You might have multiple choice questions, one to n completely filled boxes, where you mark multiple boxes. You can mark only one, you can mark two, you can mark three, you can even mark all of them. All these are possible answers, and you get points for the amount of correctly marked boxes, basically. And we can talk about marking later on as well, if you're interested in that. Besides multiple choice question, always marked as one to n completely filled boxes, we also have single choice questions, where you get the hint that only one answer is correct. Then you should only mark one box, the box you think is right. And the last case or type of questions, major type of questions, of course, there are slight iterations or slight alterations of these questions, are open text questions. In this case, it's the wavelet transform, a discrete wavelet transform. I can give you a hint, the discrete wavelet transform will not be an open text question in the real exam, because we never had an exercise about that in the exercises. The candidates for the open text question are always the methods we talked about in the lecture and we talked about in the exercises. So basically, a priori, k-means, then in classification we had naive bias and decision tree induction, then we had in clustering dbScan and k-means. Hopefully I'm not forgetting anything, but these major methods are candidates for an open text question. But there will be open text questions, one or two in the real exam, I can tell you. Okay, and these are the major types. And just to show you these major types, the student demo exists. On Wednesday, I will also upload the real mock exam for those who unlocked the access to the real mock exam, which is a fully fledged exam with which might have become an exam at one point. It didn't, it became the mock exam, but there are real questions in there with a real possible distribution. Of course, the real the mock exam isn't a one-to-one copy of a real exam, just to mention that. It's just an example what the real exam might look like. There will be other questions in the real exam and another focus in the real exam as well. But for trying to identify your problems, it's perfect. Should we talk about the marking for a second, or are you fine with that and we should go on with the real questions you asked in the forum? Okay, raise your hand if you want to get to know how we mark these types of questions. Raise your hand right now. 4, 5, 6. Raise your hand if, 7, 8, 9, 10. Now it's a majority, then we can quickly talk about that. Okay, for all tasks, you do not see the marking, the maximum amount of points, but for all tasks with this little squares, there's an internal marking point value for a correct mark. So let's go with the multiple choice question. Let's go with a single choice question first. So for the single choice question, of course, if you mark the correct rectangle, then you get the full amount of points. So let's say we have a point for this question, we have 2 points being internally used for that. Then if you correctly mark the correct field, then you get the full 2 points. If you mark nothing or the wrong answer, you get 0 points. Very important, if you mark a wrong rectangle in a single choice question, that's nothing bad for you. It's not as good as marking the correct thing, but you do not get negative points outside of that question. You can't get below 0 for that specific question. So in a single choice question, you have either 0 or the maximum. In multiple choice questions, it becomes a little bit more complicated. There we have also amount of points for a correct tick or correct fully marked square. Let's say that in our example, we have 1 point per correctly marked box. If you now mark the correct one, let's say 2 are correct, and 2 are incorrect. If you now mark these are the correct ones, and this is the incorrect one, the two incorrect ones. If you mark one correct one and nothing beside that, you get 1 point, because you get plus 1 point for this correct one, and things that aren't marked don't alter your grading. If you mark the two correct ones, you get 2 points, because plus one, plus one. If you mark 2 correct and 1 incorrect, you get plus one, minus one. So the same amount that is given to you for a correctly marked box is subtracted if you mark something incorrect. So in total, you would be at 1 point for this task. The same thing is, of course, true for the last box. Then you're at 0 points. Now again, if we forgot to mark the one correct one and we have 2 incorrect ones, you would be at plus one, minus two, minus one. However, outside of a task, you can get negative points, therefore you are at 0 points in this case. So you can't get negative points outside of a task, 0 points. The same is true for true false questions. If you have 2 correct ones marked and 2 incorrect ones marked, then you have 0 points. If you have 2 correct ones and 1 incorrect one marked, then you have 0 points. One correct one and 2 incorrect ones. Then you have 0 points, because plus one, minus two is minus one, but you can get below 0. Yeah?
In the true false, if I don't mark anything, it's considered wrong or 0?
If you do not mark anything, you don't get points, but you are not subtracted points. So in a case of a multiple choice question or multiple true false questions, I would always recommend you, it's just a recommendation, to mark the things you are 100% sure. And if you have something where you are 100% sure, and a second thing that you aren't 100% sure of, I wouldn't mark it because it might lead to you losing the points you got for the 100% sure thing. But that's my personal recommendation. You can do it another way if you like, of course. But if you mark, don't mark anything, it's just graded as unmarked. So you do not get points for not marking it. You do not get points from incorrectly marking it, but you cannot get points for correctly marking it as well. So basically the same grading as multiple choice questions. If you mark true and false on the same line, of course that's 0 points because there will be one correct one and one incorrect one in this line, and you get plus X points, minus X points. So nothing to win by marking two things. And the same thing is true for these ordering questions as well. You get plus X points for correctly marked, minus X for incorrectly marked, you can't get below 0. That's the basic principle. For the open text questions, of course, there's a more complicated grading scheme. You will get points. In most open text questions, there will be a little line like, write down intermediate steps, and we will give points for these intermediate steps. That means that if you miss these intermediate steps, you won't get points, even if your final result is correct. Let's say we have a priori, you can't just write down the frequent patterns, the frequent item sets. You have to write down the intermediate steps because there are points attached to these intermediate steps. However, if you have an incorrect result, you still get points for correct intermediate steps, which is a nice thing to have. Okay, that's basically the principle. Yeah? Then it's basically graded the same way as a multiple choice question. So you get plus points, plus X points for a correct one, and minus X points for all incorrect ones. So in the moment where you mark two things in a single choice question, you are at 0 points because only one is correct, and therefore you are in negative point at 0 or negative points. Negative points gets moved to 0. Okay, that's a pretty good question. I will show you the thing we recommend you to use. The problem why I've entered it in German and not in English is that these things are named differently, have many different names in English. In German, it's called Korrekturroller. In most cases, it's also translated as correction roller in English, but sometimes I see different results for that. You need something like this, a correction roller, where you can simply white out the boxes you marked, and you fully white out everything above that point. It's not important that you redraw that border, it's just important that at this point there's white surface. And for this OCR algorithm to not detect it as marked. And you simply white it out, and that's all, with something like this, a correction roller. We recommend you to buy these correction rollers for yourself, because then you have a correction roller at your place. However, there are always some people that miss their correction rollers, and we have some in our staff to go around and mark it out for you. However, then you have to raise your hand every time you want to correct something, and that wastes time for yourself. So better to have your own correction roller to do that. Yeah? when you simply try to find the place where you write it out and try to mark that again, black, blue, or things like that. How this OCR algorithm is working is basically, if I zoom out in here, we have these little black dots up here and this little helping mark, and our OCR just looks for the place where this box should be and simply looks that around 80% of that is black or white. And if it's black, it's counted as marked, and if it's black or blue or whatever, dark color, it's regarded as marked, and otherwise it's not regarded as marked. Yeah. Something that is part of this these correction notices, processing notices, is that you are not allowed to mess with these markings. I think that should be pretty clear. You shouldn't mess with them. Otherwise, you fail the exam. Your question is answered, hopefully. Then I can go back to your second question, because you only asked one question. What? Okay. Okay, perfect. Then, any other questions regarding that basic principle of exam? Something that some people have problems with is to write down the matriculation number. You have to code that as well from left to right. So if your matriculation number would be 00708152, you simply write down 00708152. Hopefully everybody is able to do that. There's a little helping thing next to that. Most times there is at least somebody who fails at that, but yeah, I can't help with that to do that. Okay. Then I would go to the questions because there is a question that has been asked in the forum. Again, I hope that this person is here today. I'm not a professor. I have to mention that again. I'm just a teaching assistant. But the question was to explain FP growth one more time, which is somewhat weird because we had an exercise for that as well. But we can do that. Specifically, the person asked where to stop the execution and how many trees we make. So I will focus on that. If that's not what you want, you have to give me a little hint that's not what you want. But we can do that. I will open up the according slide set. It's of course frequent patterns. And we have the slides for FP growth down here. I read out of this forum thread that the person understood how to build this initial FP tree. If a person is here, please interrupt me if I'm wrong. So this is hopefully clear. You scan the database, find the one item sets, then sort them according to the F list. Oh, maybe I should switch to loafing. You go sort the items according to the F list, the transactions according to the F list, and then simply end it in our FP tree by counting how often a specific item is occurring within transactions. Are there any questions so far up to this step? Okay. Then the next thing is, of course, to use this FP-tree to really find the frequent patterns. And that's done by taking a look at our header table, which is basically any item that is present within our FP-tree, and how often it occurs, and has links to every node having that. For every item in that header table, we create a so-called conditional pattern base. This conditional pattern base is then used to create the so-called conditional FP-trees. Again, I hope everybody has understood how to create a conditional pattern base. For example, for C, we take a look at all nodes having a C in it and looking at the prefixes before that node. So in this case, the node C has the node F before that. And since C occurs 3 times, we have this prefix F 3 times. And we end up with F 3 times as the conditional pattern base. Why we do not have anything from this C1 in here? Because we only have the root node before that. So there's no conditional pattern to make up here. And this is basically done for every entry in our FP-tree, and then this conditional FP-tree, these conditional frequent conditional pattern bases are used to create conditional FP-trees by themselves. So for the conditional pattern base of C, we simply create a tree with a root node and F 3 below that. Simple as that. Maybe we try to do that. So for C, we simply have something like this. And the header table attached to that, of course, would be F 3 times with a node linked to this. For every entry in that header table, we then again create the conditional pattern base. The conditional pattern for C and F, in this case, is empty, because there's nothing before that node. Therefore, we stop. And basically, that's how we can answer this question. When do we stop the execution, and how many trees do we make? We basically stop with the execution in 2 cases. One case is that we do not have any entries in the header table that have a frequency above the support value. Because if the frequency gets below the support value, it can contain frequent item sets. So we can stop there. Or secondly, we stop the different branches. Of course, it's a recursive algorithm. We create one FP-tree, but in the next level, we create five conditional FP-trees, and in the next level, we might create 3, 4, 5, 3, 5, maybe, whatever, until every branch, every recursion branch gets to an end because the conditional pattern bases are empty. And then we can't create any more conditional FP trees. And we do that until either the header tables contain no values above min support, or we do not have any more conditional pattern bases. And those are the two end criterions for FP growth. We do not have a certain fixed amount for trees we create, because that's hard to predict. It might be 100. In most cases, for our smaller examples, it might be 5, 6 trees that we have to create. This is basically, when do we stop the execution? When one of these two criterions is set. Is there any questions regarding that? Okay, don't think so. I hope this person was here today and doesn't have any more questions. I don't know. Then the second thing is that we have some other open questions that haven't been asked in this specific thread for questions in the lecture, but have been asked in the same time frame. One is regarding FP growth, I see in here. And one is regarding density connected and density reachable. Both are things that have been discussed in the exercises. However, I would answer them again if necessary. Are these persons here? Because then I will answer them in here. Otherwise, I will answer them in written form. Okay. Doesn't look like it. Then a second question was asked during this lecture that I will also answer later. Okay, that's nothing to be discussed in here. Okay, then we have some more minutes for spontaneous questions. Are there any spontaneous questions you want to ask? Yeah. First things first, you have, and I hopefully, I said that due to your question once, you will be allowed to bring a one-sided cheat sheet into the exam. It has to be handwritten, DIN A4, and only one side of that page should be written. Not two pages, only one DIN A4 side. On the side, I would recommend you to put formulas, if necessary. Formulas that are very likely to be required are, of course, formulas that are used in the exercise. In some cases, like in in some lectures, I explicitly stated that these formulas are not required for the exam. So these formulas in the frequent pattern slide set are, of course, not required, at least the formulas that are within this big table. Of course, how to compute relative support or how to do things like that are required. Also required, something that might become relevant are the imbalance ratio and the Kocinski measure, as these have also been discussed in the exercise and things like that. But basically, that's what I can tell you. I always mentioned that something isn't required if it isn't required. If I didn't tell you that, then it's probably required. If you are in doubt, you can ask me in the forum until next week once I and answering forum threads. So that's something I can offer you. I will be able to do that. However, please check first whether I said something about that in the lecture before asking. This is the minimal effort I ask you to do. And to be totally honest with you, I've seen a lot of cheat sheets in the past, and even this one-sided DIN A4 page is enough to put a lot of things on your cheat sheet. I've seen cheat sheets with everything of KDD on them, on just this little DIN A4 page. A handwriting I do not have, but there have been people that can do that. And most people would be able to put a lot of things on that as well. Any other questions? Yeah. Yeah, at least with the same min support and things like that, of course. But these two end up in the same result. That's true for the frequent pattern mining algorithms. That's not true, for example, for clustering algorithms. K-means and dbScan end up with two different results. But with the frequent pattern mining algorithms, you end up with the same, exactly same result. Any other questions? We would still have some minutes for that, but we do not have to use that. Okay, if there aren't any more questions, the last thing I can say to you, of course, is good luck in the exam. If you have questions, I will answer them until next week, Wednesday, 1 week before the exam starts. So I can make sure that I will be able to answer all of them before the exam. We have our exams to do as well. Yeah. And that's everything I can tell you. One thing, and you can, if you're not interested in that, we also got the feedback of our evaluation forms. It was quite fair. Specifically, I was interested in the open text question. We had some positive things on that, but also some negative things that are totally fair, but I wanted to say something about that. One thing was part of multiple things that my English isn't that the best. I know that. I try to improve that with every semester. I can't improve it that much from semester to semester. That's something I can't handle a lot. But at some point, hopefully, we have a professor handling that, not a research assistant, and hopefully that's better then. It's in German, but I translated that the examples, like I've done them today, have been too spontaneous. They have been spontaneous. A lot of lectures I did half for the first time this semester, because I had only half the lectures last time. And I always try to look in your faces and see whether confusion is there or not. If confusion was there, I try to come up with an example to better explain it. And if I held a lecture the first time, I'm unfortunately not able to predict which things need further examples or something like that. But next time, these things, I have some experience with that and I can give more prepared examples. Also a German thing I want to talk about is that the submissions have been too difficult compared to the exercises. That's something I want to focus on because in the last semesters, the submissions had been part of the exercises. So you would have been asked to implement the submissions, but today's submissions for the for the exercises. It was part of the preparation for the exercises. Since I knew that it's difficult to prepare that without test cases. I decided to move it out of exercises to easier stuff in exercises that prepares you better for the exam, and moved it to the submissions. And that's something that I won't change that much in the coming semesters, because I think it's important to gain some programming experience as well, and the submissions are a good way to award you for this effort, which is real effort. The exercises are designed to be done in 1.5 hours. The submissions are designed to be done in 7 hours. It's a big time difference. So that's why they are more difficult. Linked to that is that we should start the submissions earlier. That's something I would have liked to do as well. However, without me explaining a priori and k-means, I can't ask you to implement a priori and k-means. And these implementations, these submissions, do only make sense for the more complicated, more advanced algorithms. There would be no point to ask you to implement histogram analysis. That's nothing to do. So that's hard to do. I have a little idea how to get it at least 1 week earlier next time by moving OLAP to the last lecture. Maybe I will do that, but that's something I can't change that good as well. Then the next thing is that the PowerPoints are an endless list of techniques. At some point they have been, I have to admit. I try to improve on that iteratively, and I will make sure that this feedback is heard, and I try to reduce the amount of things that are on the slides from semester to semester. So that's something I try to do. And then submissions again, so yeah. So I was asked to also take a look at these things. Thank you for your feedback. If you have other feedback besides that and just didn't want to write that down, you can of course always mail me. I appreciate feedback, even also criticism. Criticism is the most important thing to improve, even if it's things that I'm not able to improve that a lot. So my English won't be better, a lot better next time. That's something I can't promise. But the things I can change, I try to improve, of course. Okay, besides that, have a nice time. See you at 1st of August at 2 p.m. In the afternoon. Have a nice time.